Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and it's a Larry Mueller Show Book Club Day. Always fun to do that. And as I always do at the start of the show, it's a chance to remind you how we make our selections. We do six selections a year. Every other month we have one. And we zero in on the author has to be from Wisconsin, or the author has to have written the setting about Wisconsin, or a Wisconsin author who's writing about Wisconsin. And today we've got both. We got Jeff Elzinga with us. He's an emeritus professor of writing at Lakeland University. He was former American diplomat to Africa. And he has a novel titled Pigeon Falls, and it's kind of about, I'll have him talk about it, but it's kind of a specialized team of construction workers who are working to bring wind farms into being in Wisconsin. I'll let him go into more detail on that. And I found it really a fascinating read for a variety of reasons, which we will get into as we move along here, but it's set in Pigeon Falls, Wisconsin, and I hope you'll join in with your thoughts. It's Pigeon Falls, a small community. What do you think about small community life? He does a nice job of talking about that in the book. What do you think about family farms maybe becoming sources of renewable energy? There's a lot in the news even today about that, I believe, in Marathon County, where there's a wind farm being proposed, and some resistance to it among the folks who live in that area. At any rate, I hope you'll join in, and hopefully you've read the book. If you haven't, that's fine. You can call and ask questions anyway. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Jeff Elzinga, welcome. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you, Larry. I'm very happy to be here with you.
Here you've got a construction crew building concrete bases for enormous wind turbines. How did you hit on this for the basis of a novel?
Well, when I first came up with the idea for the book, it was many years ago. I was living in Madison with a couple of friends. It was October. We were kind of out of money. And we heard about a construction job in Iowa. And at that time, we got the job. We went out there and we built concrete hog confinements.
Oh!
Now, this is the middle of the 1970s. I gave up on the idea then and brought it back about 40 years later. Hog confinements were not a big deal at that time. And I thought, how can I get a construction crew that works with concrete and rebar? And I came upon the idea of the guys who make the platforms for wind turbines. And they use concrete and rebar. And that worked its way into the story.
Well, it's a kind of a fascinating story. And Pigeon Falls, there are a lot of themes. There's that construction theme. That's kind of one of the themes which I found fascinating. And there are other themes. What do you want to say about these people by telling this story, the small town life?
Well, I think the theme about construction is there is the idea of teamwork in the story, and that balance between, you know, what are the desires of an individual and the needs of a team or a family or a community, and how do you balance those two different things? So that's one of the themes. I think there's also a theme about that talks about greed, and to what point do we compromise our values and our self-respect to earn money, even with a construction crew. I think there's probably also another theme about heroism. You know, when we are given an opportunity to help someone, do we step back or do we step forward? And it's not always an easy choice of what you do. So those are some of the themes. Setting it in a small town like Pigeon Falls, I got to work with the community more, some of the characters who who live in the town and the issues, the situations that they're dealing with every day.
And you do a nice job of capturing, I think, the essence of the folks who live there.
Oh, thank you.
It was really cool. Well, let's talk about the wind turbines for a bit. I thought the detail in this, it was so fascinating to me, the work that goes into this, these wind turbines.
It surprised me, too, when I started to investigate. And I would go out and look at wind turbines, and not only for the kind of the aesthetic of how they move, because I was fascinated by that, but also what is involved in building one. So I looked at a lot of videos online, read a lot of reports on how they're built, and kind of wove that into the story.
And when I was reading it, I thought, I wonder if he worked on one of these. Because you seem to know so much about just the base of the turbine to put it in.
It was just a lot of study.
And the exactness that it has to be, and the amount of, I mean, how much concrete? I forgot how much concrete goes into one of those bases.
I don't remember myself, but it was a lot. And part of it was because the narrator is the surveyor.
Yeah.
So he's very much interested in numbers and precision. So if he's telling the story, he's going to tell us how wide the base is and how high it is and, you know, how far apart you put everything, because he's measuring all that.
Tom Bishop is the, if I'm not mistaken, was the narrator in the story. Well, why don't you explain kind of the story itself? Give us the rough outline of what's all going on, because, I mean, winter's coming. There's a bunch of things going on.
Okay. It's a construction crew that travels around the upper Midwest, and they build the platforms for wind turbines, the part that goes underground and anchors the turbine tower to the ground. And they mostly work from April till October. They have now finished their normal work season because it's now the end of October, but the weather has been exceptionally warm. There's been a second summer, or some people say an Indian summer, that is permitting them to do one more job. So they've been called to take on this responsibility of putting another platform in, and they want to do it before the weather turns cold. So there's kind of a rush to get this done, because once it gets too cold, you can't put concrete and rebar together without putting a chemical in there, which then eats away the rebar. So that's kind of why we don't see a lot of road construction in the wintertime.
Well, where it's being installed is outside of town on a hog farm.
Yeah, it's an old hog farm that the family of this farmer had, and he's trying to do something to find success in his family. His family and generations before him have tried to grab that American dream and been unsuccessful, and he's kind of desperate now. He got a grant from the government to build this wind farm on his property. There's an exceptional current of wind that goes through because of the contours of the land, and he wants to get it done, and he'll stop at nothing to do that.
And he's not the nicest guy you ever met either.
He's not. No.
And he has he's got the money. The money came from?
The money came from the federal government because of a different program that he got involved in.
Yeah. So he had the money. You know, and throughout the book, the benefits of clean wind energy is talked about, but concerns about some environmental damage come to play. And government funding of wind farms also, as you say, was mentioned. How do you feel about wind energy?
I think the future is, I mean, the farmer does say this too, that the future is renewable energy. It has to be. And whether it's wind or solar or wave energy, whatever, I think that's the way we're going to eventually have to go.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. And most of the crew has worked together on these sites for a long time. And the crew follows, I think it's two rules?
That's right. One is to lend a hand whenever anyone needs help, and the other is can't talk on the job about politics or religion.
I think that's a really good, those are two really good rules. Always lend a hand and don't talk about politics or religion with the people that you work with.
And it seems to work for them.
Yeah. Jeff Elzinga, our guest today, and we'll take your calls. If you want to have a question or comment, maybe you've read the book and want to comment on it, the number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or shoot us an email. The email address is talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Our book club selection for this month is titled Pigeon Falls. Jeff Elzinga is the author of the book. And again, if you want to join in with your questions or comments, I hope you will. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, and the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Chris in Cooksville has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Hi there, Larry and guest. What a wonderful program. What a wonderful interviewer you've been over these decades. Thank you for what you've done. My gosh.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Chris.
You'll be missed. I'm very environmentally minded, and I need to be told how efficient wind generators are. And I know that concrete is one of the biggest polluters, and here we're building platforms of concrete, enormous amounts of concrete to support a tower. Then the disposal of the blades after they're used, they're just burying them in Wyoming. These things really bother me. I need to be told that they're efficient and more useful and smarter than coal.
All right. So Chris wants to know a little bit more about the wind energy and its efficiencies and what goes into it.
Well, I wish I could speak more specifically. Maybe some of the power companies would know more of those details. And I think with any kind of energy, there are the trade-offs and even nuclear energy, you know, mm-hmm. which can produce a lot of power. You have disposal things you have to worry about there too, and wind energy and solar, they have materials. Some of those are not easily repurposed, and you have to deal with those, and it is a trade-off.
Well, and one of these turbines is going to last, what is it, 20 years?
Yeah, 20 to 25 years.
20 to 25 years. And I think you have Tom Bishop and the crew surveyor saying that the platforms are, I think he says, 290 feet tall, and they weigh about 180 tons. So you've got that, but you're talking about that over 25 years, and then if you think of the amount of pollution that comes from, let's say, coal or other gas and other things of that nature, if you look at what if you had to spend that same amount on of money that you spend and environmental money, let's call it that you spend on wind versus coal or gas, I think over the 20, 25 years, you're going to find out that the wind is going to come out ahead.
I think that's really a good point. There is an enormous upfront cost, but unlike coal, which you're putting coal into the power plants every week or every month, in wind, the wind just keeps going, and you're not replacing the cement in the platform. You're not replacing the rebar all the time. You're not even replacing the tower and the blades that much, so they last a long time.
Yeah, and I think those bases are going to last even beyond if you put another. You could put another wind generator on top of that base.
Yes,
So that base is in there for probably longer than 25 years.
And the narrator in the story does talk about that his legacy, because he's divorced, he has no children, he's wondering what his legacy is, and he thinks it is the platforms that he's building, because after he's gone, they will continue to service a lot of other people that'll benefit.
Yeah. Chris, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too. Number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. The company is called, you call it Midwest Stable Platforms, is the name of the company. And you say it's a business that takes care of its people. What do you mean by that?
Well, my experience seeing a lot of different businesses is, and reading about things, of course, in the newspaper and on the news, that profit is really the thing that drives most businesses. And there's almost never enough profit. And the people who end up taking kind of the short part of that are the workers. And, arguing over benefits, arguing over salary, arguing over working conditions. Well, Midwest Stable Platforms takes a different approach. They certainly want profits. I mean, they're in business to, be in business.
Make money.
Right. But they take care of their workers. They look after them. They support them. They go to bat for them. And that's why the narrator likes the company so much. And they're successful because of it.
Yeah, and the guys that work together are working together in really as a unit, and everybody's helping everybody, but they all have their specific tasks. But you lend a hand where somebody else needs to help immediately. And you write about, one of the things that really caught my eye was you write about the music of work. And I was going to ask you, because I thought you did a nice job with that, if you could talk about the music of work.
Well, I got the idea for that, and it wasn't at the beginning, of course, of writing the book, but it came along. One of my sons works in the construction trades, and mostly building houses or renovating houses. And I've watched him work at times, and there's always music playing on the job site. And it seems like the guys that he works with like that, and that's where I got the idea from.
And in this case, the music had to go away.
In this case, the music had to go away. We see this progression when talking about the theme of greed throughout the story. Is the construction crew, so they work longer hours, cut back on their meal breaks, their coffee breaks, things like that, to take more money because this farmer, the client, is so set on getting this tower up in time before the winter comes. Well, one of the things that they also give up on is their music.
Yeah. Wait, could you give us a reading from the book? That?
Sure.
Yeah.
This would be then a short piece where the farmer has just paid the crew $500 each cash, no taxes, to give up the playing of their music at work. So there's no more radio, no more boombox. This is fairly early in the story. All afternoon we make good progress. Joyce's delicious meal and our not having to drive to town for lunch have opened unexpected reserves of energy in all of us. And just as Burnell wanted, not listening to music has also helped us focus solely on the job in front of us. Though by mid-afternoon, I've also noticed that we've stopped talking to one another. You might think we'd talk more without music, that we'd fill in the silence with conversation, but we don't. The rest of the afternoon continues to roll out in this muted way, and after a while, I feel like I'm laboring alone. A solitary and soundless emptiness has taken hold of me. With friends working right beside me, it's illogical to feel as isolated as I'm feeling now. So I say nothing about it to anyone. Then, out of the quiet, I notice the high-pitched pinging sound of a hammer pounding a nail. Then the whoosh of a shovel cutting dirt. Determined footsteps are shuffling their comings and goings. A toolbox opens and closes. Up on the nest, someone sighs, and I know whose breath it is. Behind me, there's the creak of a wooden pallet, followed by the clang from steel batting steel. When Eddie groans, I finally understand what I'm listening to, the music of work. All around me are the daily melodies a construction crew makes when building something important. I've heard these tunes 1,000 times before, but until this afternoon, I never stopped to listen. This afternoon's absence of conversation and the jailing of Buck's boombox had me feeling uneasy. It had my mind wandering in places I'd rather not go. Now, each whirl of a drill is brightening my mood. Each turn of Bud's crane is lifting my spirits. Up on Burnell's Plateau, we're making our own playlist, a construction crew's playlist. And if I had the right words, I could sing along.
That's a wonderful piece. And thank you so much for reading it. So the music of work. There you have it. We'll take some more calls. I have plenty more questions, but let's take a call from Jack in Madison. Jack, thank you so much for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi. I just wanted to mention that I feel like you guys, a point that was missed earlier versus the regarding the cost of, say, coal or natural gas plants versus wind or solar, is that there's a lot of resources consumed in the building of a coal or natural gas plant and its eventual decommissioning. And I think if you look at the numbers on that, the amount of resources probably equal or exceed those of a wind farm or a solar farm. So that was just, I feel like that point got missed and wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, Jack, thanks for bringing that up. I think he's right about that, Jeff.
I agree. And, yeah, I'm not advocating in the book for one or the other. In fact,
no.
there's a part in the book where the construction company, of course, is very positive about wind energy. They believe in it completely. And then there's this young guy who's part of the crew, and he brings up all of these negatives about it, which the rest of the crew is not ready for. But, I'd agree with the caller that renewable is the way for the future.
Jack, thank you very much. Meg emailed to say she loved your book, especially the relationship among the workers and then the relationship between the workers and the community. Can you talk about your approach to building character and relationships in fiction?
Well, that's a good question, and it's one that I ask myself all the time, too, because creating real, believable characters does take a lot of thought and work. I think I build character the same way I build a story. I start with sort of the basics, try to figure out who's doing what, and then it's almost like oil painting, where you put a layer of color on, you put a detail on, and then you add more to it, and you add more to it, and you add more to it. And you refine, you revise, you change things. And at the end, you have a lot more depth. So when I created the different characters, those on the crew and those in town, I tried to give each one something that would make him or her stand out more. And that's what I tried to do.
David in Kenosha, it's your turn. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to indicate I've read the book, Pigeon Falls, and I found it excellent, and the story character development was done very well. My question, though, to the author, does he have any other books in the hopper that he might be working on?
Yeah, maybe talk about your first book, and because what you're working on now relates to the very first one you wrote.
The first one I wrote that was published in 2020, right at the beginning of the pandemic, takes place in Africa, and it's a story about an American diplomat and his relationship with a visiting American journalist. The journalist goes missing into the bush during a civil war, the beginning of a civil war in a country, and the diplomat has to go looking for him. The problem in the story is that the diplomat and the journalist don't see eye to eye. the end of the story, something happens to the diplomat, and the book I'm working on now is where is that diplomat 10 years later? So that's what I'm working on.
And the reason for that is a lot of people asked.
A lot of people asked, what happens to the so-and-so?
Yeah, and that the first book, The Distance Between Stars, was the title of that, and that was a finalist for the Midwest Book Award.
Yes, yeah, it was.
As well. So there's one already done, and there's another one in the hopper, David, I guess. And glad to know that you enjoyed the book. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And you can join in, too. Hope you do. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. And that relationship between the people in the community and the workers was really well done. And they're in town a lot. I mean, explain what that part of it.
Well, since they're a traveling crew, they have to stay somewhere, and they find this place that has rooms to let, and they also have a bar, and they also have a restaurant. So they eat their meals. Well, they start eating all their meals there. They eat all of their dinners there, and they stay in the rooms. So in the course of being in Pigeon Falls, they get to know the bartender, they get to know the waitresses, they get to know some of the townspeople who come into the barn.
And there's some really good discussions. I mean, you have a kind of a nice one between the gal who runs the post office, as an example, and I think it's Tom that comes in and to send something out in the mail and gets into a discussion about Pigeon Falls itself and how it got its name.
Yeah, and in fact, there are these photographs on the wall of the Horseshoe Inn where they're staying, and he's looking at them one day, and a lady comes up behind him, and she's sort of like the town historian, I think. She knows.
Yeah.
She's been there seven or four generations herself. I think she says her grandchildren are the seventh generation or something like that, and he's looking at all these old black and white photographs, and she takes him through who different people are and what the town was like 100 years ago, and then eventually gets to a discussion about how the town got its name.
And the town...
Which is a true story.
And that was probably during the time of, if I'm not mistaken, during the passenger pigeon time. I looked up and did a little research on myself on it, and apparently there was a roosting areas up there for millions of passenger pigeons, and they literally would break the branches. And she did it. And that conversation was just a really cool conversation. I'm probably mixing it up with another conversation he had at the post office, or maybe the gal was a postal worker, and I've forgotten that. It's been a few weeks since I finished the book, so I really remember, but I really enjoyed that conversation between the two of them. You capture those conversations really well, I think.
Well, thank you. She was an interesting character, too, that she has all of these sayings and proverbs and whatever that she brings up at different times throughout the story.
One of the things you talk about that you probably must have lived, that you talk about the pressure of wind on your body as you work.
I've noticed it myself, and that's why I did put it in the book, knowing that there was wind in this area, a lot of wind. And I then did some research on it and talk a little bit about how sailors in the old days on sailing ships, the wind would be so fierce that it could drive someone crazy.
Yeah, and of course you're working on a wind farm.
Right,
you're building a wind farm, and you're in an area. It was a pretty cool area where the wind is constantly really blowing all the time.
Right, it's not a normal wind. It's really a super wind.
How much, let's talk about that area. It's, you know, a small town. Pigeon Falls actually exists, small town in western Wisconsin. And I'm wondering how much of your description of the community match the real town of Pigeon Falls. It's just south of Eau Claire.
I think about 30 miles south of Eau Claire. I visited it a number of times to get a feel for the town as well as the lay of the land and the driftless area. I tried to be true to the feeling that I got there. I mean, this is a wonderful, quiet community, people caring about each other. They have a real nice life there. It's very small. I've eaten in places in town, but the Horseshoe Inn, where it's kind of the center of the story, is made up. I didn't use a real place there.
Well, I you had me wanting to go for that special on Saturday night, was it?
The spaghetti and ribs.
Spaghetti and ribs. I thought, apparently people came from 50 miles away to come and have the spaghetti and ribs on a Saturday night. What are the, have you gotten reaction from people who live in Pigeon Falls about the book?
Maybe about an hour from now I might.
Oh, are you on your way there?
No, but if I get any emails or something.
Well, maybe somebody from Pigeon Falls is listening in and can give a call. It'd be fun to know what folks. You should do a reading there, for goodness sakes.
That would be great. There is a wonderful little town, very nice town.
One of the areas that we haven't really touched on, part of the book, is, in my mind, domestic abuse comes into play in your novel.
Yeah, it's a crucial storyline through the novel, and what happens and how the crew reacts, and it at the end of the story everything is kind of tied together. But it wasn't originally in the plan when I first laid out the novel. But again, as things develop and I'm changing things here and there, and this sounds like something I want to talk about.
Yeah, and it has to do with one of the waitresses. And this is how you get, I'm thinking about this because I've thought all the way back to my PhD research, where I was doing PhD. My research was in some relatively small communities, Neillsville, Cumberland, Barron, relatively small communities, but I would be there for a week at a time to do the work. And so I got a chance. You do get a chance to meet people. You meet people at the restaurant. You meet people at the hotel. You meet, and you have a chance to interact. And I felt like you were capturing kinds of things that I felt about when I have been in those kind of situations myself. Well, I wasn't building a wind turbine, but I was building a research project is what I was doing with another guy, Glenn Broom. And I found those interactions really great.
Well, I think one of the things that helps is the character who is the waitress, that she's very outgoing, and she's very friendly to everyone, and she immediately strikes up a good conversation with all of the crew members, and they kind of take a liking to her. She's very young. She's just almost a year out of high school, and when they notice some of the bruising on her wrists and whatever, they take even more interest in her because they like her so much already, that develops one thing into another. The narrator gets involved. Other crew members get involved, and things kind of escalate from there with her husband.
Yeah, absolutely. Got an email from Lee who says that he loved the book, especially the character Burnell, and he was so well-written, Lee could hear his voice and see his expressions. Was he based on an experience of the authors or someone or a compilation of people he's known? Could you speak to the development of this character, Burnell? And you should tell us about the character Burnell and what he was like.
Well, Burnell is desperate to be successful. In fact, he's desperate to be rich. He sees the American dream as something that he's been unable to hold on to. And he wants to have a lot of money. He wants to be successful. That's how he interprets success. But he's also got an edge to him, and he's kind of a mean guy, and he's demanding, and he thinks because, you know, he has this loan from the federal government to build this big project, and he's kind of a know-it-all. He likes giving orders, and I mean, maybe that's just in his family's DNA, but he's real good at it, and that's part of the friction that is between him and then the construction crew. Did I know anybody like that? When I started writing the book, I never thought of the book in any political way. That was not an intention. But readers, early drafts, pointed out that some of the mannerisms of Burnell Sandberg mimicked people that they knew in the news. And I started to realize that, yeah, I guess subconsciously, maybe I was. He's unkind. He's selfish. He's demanding. He's unreasonable. And, yeah, I guess maybe that's true.
Our guest today, Jeff Elzinga, his novel Pigeon Falls. Join in with your questions or comments as we move along. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you listening in today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jeff Elzinga. Coming up at noon today, we'll talk about liability insurance with my good friend, attorney Michael Riley. So looking forward to that. And tomorrow on the show, Melinda Myers joins us to talk about landscaping with pollinators in mind. And then we'll talk to organic gardener Tova Martin about the indoors and outdoors of houseplants and making that transition work. That's tomorrow on Garden Talk. But right now we're looking at Jeff Elzinga's novel, Pigeon Falls, a great, really fun novel to read, and it's our book club selection for this month. Questions or comments, if you've read the book or just have a question, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Just go back to that domestic abuse for a bit. Candace is reluctant to get the police involved. Why?
I think part of it is there's a part that she denies that it's really as bad as it is. She wants to believe that the person she's just married a few months earlier isn't going to be like that. He always, you know, apologizes, sends her flowers, does things like that, that, oh, I didn't really mean it. And she's sort of early into the cycle.
Yeah.
I think she's a very smart person. She spent a year at university. He kind of forced her out, started to gain control of her life, got her to be a waitress. He's always monitoring her activities, the husband. She's starting to realize that something's really not right. She gives excuses for his behavior. You know, he was kind of bullied by his father. He doesn't like rules. And she uses those as excuses. But the crew now have started to tell her, wait a minute, this is not right, Candace. You got to do something about this.
And she talks to Tom in the book, the narrator, about the philosophical concept of loving one's fate.
Right. And There's this idea, it's called amor fati, and loving one's fate, a concept that came out 19th century, Friedrich Nietzsche. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a spokesman for the concept or an expert in Nietzsche, but I think what he would say is that this idea is you make the best of whatever life throws at you, and that whether it's good or bad, you learn from it. And I don't think Nietzsche meant it in any way that this was an excuse for pain and suffering or things like that, or to give up on life as if there's nothing you can do about what happens to you. It's not fatalism, maybe the opposite of that. It's that, you know, when bad things do happen, when there is misfortune, take advantage of the things you can control, and move your life forward that way, which is what Candace is trying to do.
Yeah, that's well put. And Tom, the narrator, there's also a health aspect to this as well, in the sense that Tom is suffering from stomach pain, digestive issues, and so that plays a role, and because it's kind of in the back of his mind as things go along in the book.
It is, and again, another part of the storyline. I think if I hadn't had that as part of it, that Tom having these medical questions, I might have written the book in third person, but it's written in first person because I wanted the reader to be closer to him and get his thoughts a little more directly. The book starts where he's going to a clinic for some tests, and the story kind of ends with him going back to the clinic to get the results. And along the way, we know that his diet has changed and he's feeling some discomfort and whatever.
Yeah, it's always in the back of his mind, and it's always in the back of your, obviously, then, and myself as a reader, or any other reader probably, is what's going to happen to Tom down the road. One of the things I enjoyed were his musings as he drove through the community, and that's a, I think, well, talk about how you put that together, because you must have experienced some of that.
At the beginning, you mean when he's going from the clinic to Pigeon Falls? Or
And when he is, yeah, and then driving around Pigeon Falls, too, it comes into play.
Well, I wanted to, you know, I think the setting, of course, is really important, and I wanted to set the stage for how the village was constructed, how the landscape around the village was. People get a feeling for the little creeks and rivers that are there, the bluffs, the escarpment that goes up, and the wind towers on the top, the types of trees that are around, their colors now. The story takes place, begins on Halloween.
It's
the end of October. As he's driving through some of the surrounding villages on his way to the job site, to Pigeon Falls, he goes through a town that has trick-or-treaters out, and the police are stopping the traffic, and the little kids are going across the street. And he looks around, and he sees, again, another kind of quiet town, and the people doing their normal daily activities.
And that comes into play, I think, too, in the, I mean, there's a fire, which gives you a chance to talk about community working together as well.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I guess in this short time period, because the book takes place over only about a week and a half.
Yeah,
there are a number of incidents that happen, and I wanted to keep the story moving along, and hopefully that's what happened.
Yeah, and there are some others. We're not going to have time to go into it all. John wants to know about your approach to writing. How do you develop? In other words, how do you come up with a novel, and how do you work on the novel?
Well, when I was growing up, I think I was always interested in stories. There were stories on television. There were a lot of Westerns and detective stories when I was growing up, 30 minutes on television. And they always had a beginning, middle, and end. Then I would read stories by Ernest Hemingway, John Steinbeck, J.D. Salinger, James Joyce. And they always had a beginning, middle, and end. And at the end, you felt that it was complete, that you learned something and something happened and was resolved or wasn't resolved. So I wanted to create something like that. I'm not a genre writer. I can't write science fiction or fantasy. It's just not in my ability to do that. So I like to just tell a story about real people and some of the situations they come up with. So when I had the first novel, I had a situation that I wanted to investigate. With this one, I wanted to write about a crew, and I wanted to write about a farmer and how they don't see eye to eye. And so I got where it was going to take place. I kind of got the beginning of the story, the end of the story, and then I tried to fill in between. And again, this layering effect. So many details happen in the 9th, 10th, 11th draft that I never even thought about originally. And then I can readjust the story to make some of those work, and hopefully it adds, you know, depth to the story.
And how much time do you spend, I mean, in the course of a week? Is it one of those where you're writing certain number, amount of time every day, or how do you approach that? I think is part of his question, too.
Well, when I'm able to, which when I'm really involved, like I am in the story that I'm writing now, I try to do 3 to 4 hours a day. 4 hours is good. To go beyond that, my brain kind of is squeezed out pretty much. But if I can get up a momentum of 2 or 3 weeks of 3 or 4 hours a day, then I'm going full steam, and then it's productive.
Yeah, that's a lot of other writers I've talked to say that they spend like a similar amount of time, and your mind starts to wander a bit after 3-4 hours, and you're not as productive as you were when you began. Or maybe there's a little tough beginning, but then you get rolling, and then you're rolling for quite a while, and then your mind starts to wander, and then you say, wait a minute, I better go get lunch. Are you a morning guy?
It's morning. But the funny thing is, so many good ideas come right before I fall asleep at night. So I keep a legal pad next to the bed. Sometimes I'll wake up in the middle of the night, have an idea. If I don't write those down, the next day I won't remember them. But sometimes it'll be a sentence, it'll be a word, it'll be a situation, and I make a note of it, and they don't always work, but sometimes they do.
Well, it's they work pretty well this time around, Jeff, and it's been a lot of fun talking with you. The book, hopefully you will sell some more copies of it today as a result of being on the show, but it's been a pleasure to talk with you about it. I enjoyed it, and I'm pretty sure our listeners, well, the listeners we've heard from all enjoyed it very much. So, Jeff, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me on your program. It's an honor.
It's my last interview with a book club author. So you're the last one, Jeff. Lee Rayburn will be doing it a couple months from now with our next offer. But in the meantime, thank you so much for writing Pigeon Falls and for being with us today.
Thank you.
Jeff Elzinga is the author of his first book, The Distance Between Stars. But this book is titled Pigeon Falls. It's a novel. I think you'll enjoy reading it if you haven't done so already. Coming up, we're going to take a look at some legal things. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Wisconsin requires auto owners and drivers to carry a minimum amount of liability insurance. That's meant to cover medical expenses or attention for any injuries you suffer to your vehicle in the event of a car crash. We're talking about the ins and outs of liability insurance across a number of life forms here as we talk with retired Madison attorney Michael Riley back with us. And we'll certainly get into insurance questions with him. And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Mike Riley, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Larry, it's so great, and I really feel honored that I'm kind of part of the final group here.
Well, it's great to have you here, and you and I have been doing a show together.
I think it's 30 years, which, like everything, is hard to believe.
It is hard to believe. But we talk about insurance coverage issues, and it's not only a car accident. There's all kinds of situations where you need some liability insurance.
There really is, and we'll talk about cars first, because cars are obviously the biggest source of potential liability. Yeah. The kind of thing where you really can lose a lot if you don't have the proper insurance. And also the kind of thing where you really need to know that you got a company that's going to stand behind you, that's going to do the right thing, that's not going to expose you, you know, to an unnecessary lawsuit or trial or any of those sorts of things. So let's just talk about auto insurance kind of quickly.
Sure.
Auto insurance, as you said at the start, now it's a 25-50, which means that you have to have liability coverage, which is the coverage that applies if you injure someone and it's your fault. So the 25 means the most a single injury to one person. The 50 is everybody. So if you got a car full of people, you've only got 50,000. That's really inadequate.
Very inadequate.
It is. And, you know, just with, you mentioned medical expense, and you know, you think about when I started practice at the beginning of time, just after the comet took out the dinosaurs. Really, if we saw 5,000, 10,000 maybe in medical bills, that was a lot of medical bills. Now, just before I was retiring a couple of years ago, I mean, we'd see 50 to 100,000. An emergency room visit can be $20,000. So, you know, if you have the misfortune to be in an accident where you're at fault, I mean, $25,000 doesn't even pay the bills in a lot of cases. So we used to have $100,000 to $250,000, which is what the minimum anybody should have, really, in my view. And obviously, some of it is what do you have to lose? You know, what are your assets, your home, you know, your savings, whatever you may have. But for almost anyone, certainly anyone with a home these days, boy, they're worth a lot of money now.
Yeah.
And you really need to protect yourself. So the first thing I always recommend is make sure you've got at least that. Talk to your insurance company about what it costs for a policy that will qualify you to buy an umbrella policy. Because umbrella policies are very cheap compared to the primary coverage. You know, the primary coverage, because obviously what they're concerned about first is what's the risk you're going to have an accident and injure somebody. And that's always going to be much higher than the risk that somebody's going to have an injury that's, you know, worth $100,000, $300,000, $500,000, $1,000,000. Those are rare, but they happen, and they happen a lot more now than they used to happen. So if you get an umbrella policy, that will be really quite cheap compared to what you're paying for your primary coverage or even the coverage for damage to your car. I mean, that's probably the least expensive coverage you're going to get. We'll talk a little bit about underinsured in a minute. But for liability, that is the key, because you can buy $2 million in coverage, and the chances that you're ever going to have an accident that would produce that kind of an injury are almost zero. I mean, that's very, very rare. So at least look into that and see if that doesn't make sense to do it that way. Buy the amount of coverage you have to buy to qualify for an umbrella, because they're not going to let you buy $25,000, $50,000 and then sell you an umbrella. You know, they're going to want you to have a certain level of coverage. But that's, I think, the starting point with liability coverage. And it really is important. There is liability coverage as well on your homeowner's policy. And again, if you get an umbrella, it will like make sure it's going to extend to that as well. Probably the biggest risk, I mean, yes, somebody can slip and fall on your property, you could, but the biggest risk to me is dog bites. Mm. And one of the things that's happened with the insurance industry is, again, because the way medical expenses have increased and their perception of what the risk is has obviously increased to match that, they have, many companies have now limited the amount of coverage you have for dog bites. So you may have $100,000, which is kind of the standard for liability coverage, but your dog bite coverage may be only $25,000. We had a case not all that long ago with a young woman who literally had her nose bitten off by her friend's dog. And the doctors did a remarkable job with plastic surgery. I mean, really remarkable. But that notwithstanding, the costs of that were astronomical. And I think the case ultimately settled for right around $500,000. So, you know, that risk is out there. And again, is that likely to happen? No, of course not. But you don't buy insurance necessarily for what's likely. I mean, your house isn't likely to burn down either. But you're certainly not going to underinsure your house just because it isn't likely. So anyway, I mean, those are some of the things. And one last thing, just I always mention this because I think it's important, and that's underinsured motorist coverage. That's not liability. Liability coverage protects you against something that, you know, that happens because of your fault. The other coverages on auto insurance are basically what they call first-party coverages, which means they're coverages that protect you. So medical payments coverage, you know, regardless of fault, that's there to help pay the medical bills. It's inadequate, but it's there. And, you know, it might pay your deductible or some of those things, co-pays, whatever. But underinsured motorist coverage covers a situation where someone else injures you through their fault. So you have a claim against them, and there are a shocking number of people who have insurance because they're required to, but they have the $25.50. And as we've said, that's not very much. So underinsured benefits you because if they don't have enough coverage, then your own insurance carrier has to step in and pay you whatever up to the limits of your own underinsured motorist coverage. If they had no insurance, you get uninsured coverage, which is also first party. But again, it's much more common now to see somebody who has some insurance, but just not enough.
Not enough. Dennis in Two Rivers has a question, I believe, relating to what we've been talking about here. Let's go there. Dennis, hi.
Hi. Yeah. People talk often about having umbrella policies to cover their assets in case they're sued. I have very few assets, but I figure it's my responsibility to at least cover somebody financially if I cause any injuries or property damage. And the question also is, since you were practicing back around the days of the dinosaurs, if a dinosaur stepped on somebody's property, would that be considered a force majeure?
You know, that's the problem. I don't think, based on all the movies I've seen, the dinosaurs really just didn't care, and I don't think they ever carried insurance.
Veronica, I'd email.
But Dennis, that's a really laudable attitude. Yeah. I mean, that is, it's wonderful that you take that approach. And unfortunately, that's not, I'm afraid, the majority opinion, but it certainly is the responsible opinion.
Veronica emailed, she's getting solar panels installed on our roof, and We Energy is requiring her to increase her liability coverage to $300,000 from $100,000 for liability coverage. And she wants to know, do you know why they want to do that?
No, I think you saw the quizzical look on my face, Larry. I can't imagine why. I mean, I suppose in theory, what, the panels could blow off and land on someone? But, I mean, talk about highly, highly unlikely. I just can't imagine. But that's, you know, that kind of plays into something else that I know we've talked about, and that is people's perception of risk, including companies like We Energy and companies in general, is way, way out of proportion to the actual risk. I coached all sorts of sports, and I was on the board of, you know, some of the sports organizations I coached in. And boy, questions would always come up. Well, if I'm coaching and if somebody breaks their leg, you know, well, you know, you're not liable for that. I mean, the chances of you being liable as a coach for something are vanishingly small. I'm not saying it's zero, but it's so close to that that to spend a lot of time worrying about it, you know, it's not worthwhile. Doesn't mean you shouldn't have insurance coverage and the right amount. But people, you know, let's face it, when you see something in the newspaper about a jury verdict or somebody getting, you know, lots of money for an injury, nobody's putting in the paper an average jury verdict. You know, somebody has a soft tissue injury and they get 30,000 or 40 or whatever it might be. That doesn't make the paper. Somebody gets a million, you know, on up, and it does. And I think that just skews people's perception of what the real risk is.
That makes sense. Mike Riley, our guest today, we're talking with him on liability and insurance. And of course, his business, he worked to get fair compensation for people who suffer injuries. It was part of his job. And he's represented clients on insurance coverage issues, mediation, arbitration, counsel attorney at the Axley Law Firm. Questions for him, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at some legal issues today with Mike Riley. Mike O'Reilly, a retired Madison attorney. He's been, he and I have been talking together on the show for 30 years, probably. It's great to have him back with us as we talk a bit about liability, among other things. But David in Middleton, I believe, has a liability question. So let's go there. Hi, David.
Hello, Larry and guests. My question is this. I've currently got a liability case working through an attorney. And as an example, let's say that the homeowner has $100,000 worth of liability insurance, and I win, and the lawyer takes 33 1/3% of that. There's $66,000 left over. Has there ever been a case where the monies that have been expended to, you know, work the case, investigate, office time and stuff, that gets wiped away and I'd get nothing, in fact, might owe something? Is there, I mean, how does that, I mean, if I win, but I might potentially lose?
Yeah, I mean, has it ever happened? I'm sure it has. I hate to say that as a lawyer, but, you know, it shouldn't. The only case, honestly, where it could happen would be a case where you need a lot of experts, and experts cost money. It's one of the reasons that lawyers are really reluctant to take medical malpractice cases, because those cases are incredibly expensive. They're hard fought. They don't settle the way most other cases do. I mean, other cases in this day and age, probably 90% plus, probably more like 95, settle either through negotiation or through mediation, where you bring in a third party to help you. And mediation has really, it's a great thing for clients, honestly, and not probably terrible for lawyers, but you can't train young lawyers because there are no trials to train them with anymore. Yeah. And it also makes it hard to value cases because, again, you're not seeing any jury verdicts, which traditionally was one of the ways you said, okay, well, if they got that for this case, you know, maybe this is what we should get for ours. But at any rate, The only other cases other than MedMail, if you've got a products case, you know, that's the kind of case that could generate a lot of expert fees. But frankly, any competent lawyer would look at that very carefully before he even took the case, and would certainly look very carefully before he decided to go beyond just trying to mediate a case and, you know, push it to trial. Because once you start doing that and you get experts and you get expert depositions, the other side has experts, you depose them, I mean, that can get very expensive, but that's highly, highly unusual. Is this based on like a fall or a dog bite? Because you mentioned homeowners, so when an auto case, obviously.
Right. Yeah, it involved my wife, who was walking our dog, got attacked by an off-leash dog, and we know that the person has homeowners renters insurance. He's a renter, and we have hired an attorney, and it's currently being, you know, worked on. So I just threw out the $100,000 figure as a guess, but
yeah, sure.
You know,
well, and that's actually, it's a good guess, because $100,000 is pretty standard basic homeowners liability coverage. You can certainly have more if it's renters insurance, though. my guess is he probably doesn't have more than that, because renter's insurance generally isn't going to carry the higher limits that some other policies might. But, I mean, has the lawyer given you thoughts on what he thinks the value of the case is?
Has not. They took it quickly, and she's currently still getting therapy for her injury.
Oh,
she
sure.
She effectively had a broken back.
Oh,
but she's healing from that, and it's just, you know, she's going through therapy, and so it's ongoing. I mean, I think it's going to get to the end of her therapy sessions at the end of this month, and we're just curious. I mean, they've been real good about contacting us and saying we're still working on it. We haven't forgotten about you. It's just something we need to work through.
And that's really an important thing in terms of what your lawyer needs to do and what you should expect. Communication to me is one of the very first things. As if a lawyer is staying in touch, is keeping you advised of things. I mean, I don't know where the medical bills are, and you know, I don't want to second guess your lawyer on valuation. I wouldn't do that. But I will say, from what you're describing, boy, if there's a 100,000 policy, I would expect the insurance company would be putting that on the table very, very quickly.
I would think so. David, good luck with that, by the way, and thank you for calling. Appreciate it.
One final thought on that, Larry, and I know in this case, I'm sure they've already signed an agreement, and you know, a third is a very standard fee to be charged. I do think, certainly in cases like that, I know I know some other good firms would at least talk about, you know, doing something with the fee if you've got a case that's worth more than the policy limits and the policy limits are paid promptly. It's not suggesting the lawyer has any obligation to do that. They don't. But I do think, first of all, when you're hiring a lawyer, if you have a case that looks like it might be that sort of case, I would at least discuss whether, you know, the lawyer might be willing to discount the fee at the outset. It's worth talking about. And again, that's not suggesting that, you know, this lawyer should cut their fee. I'm simply saying that I think if you have that kind of case, it's a discussion worth having.
David, again, thank you. Dan in central Wisconsin has something. Let's go there. Hi, Dan.
Hi there. I got a question as far as insurance rates and everything. Every year they keep going up and up and up, and when you pay $6,000-$7,000 a year in insurance, and all of a sudden you see a lot of this advertising as far as buying insurance by bypassing your agent directly from an insurance company. What are your thoughts on something like that?
Yeah, I have some fairly strong thoughts on that. And really, I think, first of all, buying through an agent, whether it's a captive agent, like American Family has their own agent, State Farm does, and or you can go through an agent who handles a number of companies, an independent agent. And my own preference is for an independent agent, and I'm not suggesting arguments can't be made in the other direction. I think American Family particularly is a very good company, worked with them for years, and always had great relations with their people when we had cases against them. But if you go to an independent agent, he can look at several companies, he can compare rates, and I think that that's worth doing. I think also with an agent, whether it's an independent agent or a captive agent, there are questions you need to ask. What do I really need? You know, what does this give me? Are there exceptions? We just talked about the dog bite and the fact that a lot of companies limit the amount of coverage, maybe less than it is normally for liability. So, you know, I think when you're buying insurance, it's really helpful to have somebody you can talk to directly, who can give you information, who can and with an independent, they can obviously compare rates with other companies. You know, I think the problem with buying online, it's a little to me like shopping online. You know, unless I really know exactly what I want, I prefer to go into a store and try some things on and see if they fit and see if they look good. And I think with insurance, it's kind of the same thing. If you buy online, you're not likely going to get a lot of help. Maybe there'll be somebody available to answer some questions, but it's buying price, and you know that's what people tend to do. If you look at ads, everybody's always saying, and you know, people who switch to us save $367. Well, yeah, because that's why people switch, is to get something cheaper. So I think that having somebody who's really an expert in the field and handles different companies, take a look at that for you. I think that's more beneficial. I'm just not confident that buying something like insurance, which really is critically important to your financial well-being, I just don't trust going online and buying companies. I will say there are companies I think that you do that with that are pretty good companies. There are certainly a number of prominent ones who I'm not a fan of at all. So, I think, again, you're better with an agent, and to me, probably better with an independent agent.
Dan, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. You can email the talk at WPR.org. Michael, here's an email. Michael emailed to say his daughter was on Badger Care for health insurance. Then she started working and her income increased. At that time, Michael changed jobs and put his daughter on his health insurance. She's under 26 and had a number of medical expenses, but the private insurance Michael has doesn't want to pay because they claim she had alternative coverage. She's just out of college and has very few assets. How might he navigate this situation?
Yeah, I've never heard that before, to be perfectly honest, and I don't understand what is alternative coverage. I mean, if she's on their coverage, the fact that, there's all sorts of alternatives. She could have bought health insurance from, 50 different companies probably, but that's not the test, at least certainly in my experience. I mean, she's covered under his policy. If they're saying she should file with someone else, then I would say to them, who is she supposed to file these claims with? Who is it that you think she can obtain coverage from? She's not covered under Badger Care anymore. She's not covered under any other health policy, presumably, and she is covered under your policy. And that's one where I certainly would talk to them and ask for ask them for specifics. I mean, this is kind of a classic insurance company dodge, is throw something like that out there. So that would be my first step. And then the next step to me would be to go to the insurance commissioner's office and file a complaint if they continue to deny coverage. And they're generally pretty good about dealing with that, about helping you through that. So, that'd be, obviously at the end of the day, you can certainly go to a lawyer who works in that area. There's a concept under Wisconsin law with insurance companies called bad faith. And if a company denies a claim, without justification, that's bad faith, or certainly could be, and that could subject them to punitive damages, which can run pretty high. So I think there are some options, but I'd start with asking them to give me a very clear answer, and I want it in writing so that when I file my complaint or go to a lawyer, I've got it right there. It's not he said, she said.
Yeah, makes very good sense. And Michael, thanks for that email. Another email from Jane in Fox Cities. She's the beneficiary of a small trust, about $300,000, thinking about ending the trust. Jane's attorney says keep the trust because that protects the assets, but she's not sure the costs of keeping it are worth it for the $1 million liability policy. If Jane purchased another $1 million of liability coverage, would that protect the $300,000 if something happened and she was sued?
Yeah, I'm not a trusts and estates guy. In my practice, I've seen almost everything, but I think that's one area I managed to steer clear of. So, I'm just troubled by the notion. And again, I don't know what the expenses are. So I don't know. But I don't understand why you would be concerned. I don't know. Did the lawyer ask her what coverage she has? I mean, would an umbrella? First of all, I'd make sure if you're going to use an umbrella, make sure it would cover that, because that's it's not an area that I could answer. I don't know what the answer is to that. It might well. I mean, it would cover the occasion. Who's ever coming after you. That policy isn't going to be, they're not going to say, well, you have to give them the $300,000. They're going to provide you with the coverage. And again, to have an accident or to have something, I'm not sure what the lawyer thinks her exposure is. I would see her exposure as, I don't know what her liability coverage is either. I don't know what her primary liability coverage is, but I would think it makes sense to at least explore what it would cost you to get an umbrella and get an umbrella for enough money so that the chances of that ever putting the trust at risk would be very, very limited.
Yeah, yeah, that makes good sense. Makes good sense. John in Stevens Point has something. Let's go there. John, hi.
Yes, hello. Good to talk to you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Your guest had talked about umbrella liability policies, and I'm familiar with them. I'm wondering if he has an opinion on a recommended amount of coverage on that liability policy.
Well, I can tell you what my firm, my former firm, did. We all carried $2 million. I mean, we obviously have malpractice coverage that's different and separate and apart from that. But it's more a matter of, like, if we were driving on business for the firm and we're in an accident. So that's what we required, was $2 million. That's not very expensive. Again, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's not free. But I would, you know, if that's going to cover 99.999% of claims, I mean, they're just the chances of, and, you know, and it happens, and there are claims for more than that. But I mean, now you're talking about, you know, angels dancing on the head of the pin kind of stuff. I mean, it really is something that you are highly unlikely to happen. And I don't think the difference between $1 million and $2 million, again, umbrellas relatively cheap to begin with, and the difference between $1 and $2 million is likely very small. But, you know, those are things you have to weigh individually. But that would be my thought.
All right. There you go, John. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Norm in Madison. Norm, hi.
Yeah, Larry, and I appreciate your guest being on. I have a Amfram for a lot of different insurances, some Wisconsin properties and cars and et cetera. And I have out-of-state property, too, of farmland. And Amfram would not give me an umbrella. I didn't want the umbrella to cover the out-of-state property. I was fine with that. But they wouldn't give me any umbrella with that out-of-state property being there. And so the question I have, they would do it if I put it into an LLC. Should I be looking at a third-party insurance company to sit over the top of the AmFam stuff, or I put it in an LLC just for that reason?
I think putting the LLC is the simplest thing to do. I mean, that, you know, is something that any lawyer, a lawyer with the appropriate kind of practice could certainly do for not a great deal of money. And I don't understand that. I have to say, I've never run into that specific issue, but I'm kind of surprised. I don't think you could get a third party. Again, in order to buy umbrella, you have to have the primary coverage. So I'm not sure, and you might be able to, but I'm not aware of most companies being willing to write an umbrella without having the primary coverage. You could certainly look into it. It's not impossible, but to me, putting it in the LLC seems to be the simplest solution.
All right. Norm, there you go. Thanks for calling. Doug in Colfax, your turn. Hi, Doug.
Hi, thanks much. Great show. I have one more umbrella question. I own 17 rental properties, and I've got $1 million umbrella policy. And my question is that enough? And does it also include the uninsured motorist for my vehicle?
Well, no, the rental properties aren't going to be covered under your vehicle. And the uninsured motorist doesn't protect you from liability. You know, the uninsured motorist protects you if you're injured by someone who doesn't have any coverage at all, as opposed to somebody who has some coverage, which is the underinsured. With 17 properties, again, we just talked to the other caller about, I mean, we were required to carry as partners in our law firm $2 million. I think at that level, you know, you've covered almost any conceivable situation. I mean, again, when I say that, I think it was Han Solo who said, I can conceive of a lot, you know, and, you know, every lawyers have, you know, dancing in their heads, the visions of the big, big, big claim. But the fact is I had $2 million claims in my 50-year career. And, you know, it is just, they don't grow on trees. They're very rare. And the exposure from rental property, again, what's going to happen? I mean, if somebody trips and falls on your property, it doesn't make you liable. I mean, if you fail to maintain it properly and, you know, a stair collapses or something, there certainly are situations where you could be liable. But again, to imagine, one, those situations are not common, and then to imagine an injury so severe that $2 million, I mean, even $1 million, is that at all likely? No, it's not at all likely. But I think with $2 million, you know, really going to pursue you? If somebody says, okay, we'll put your lawyers, your insurance company says we're going to put $2 million on the table, are they really going to turn that down and try to go after your assets? Company's got an obligation to protect you. You know, I think it's highly unlikely that at that level, you know, it even more unlikely than at $1 million. And I think $2 million doesn't cost that much more. That's probably what I would recommend.
Probably feel better.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's what insurance, you're right, Larry, that's what it buys you more than anything is peace of mind. I mean, again, is your house going to burn down? Not at all likely, but, you know, would you want to not insure it? I don't think so.
I want to talk about, Doug, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And again, we got open lines to get you on pretty quickly at 800-642-1234. Give a call. Some emails, too. You can email to talk@WPR.org. Faith in Madison called, couldn't stay with us, but did want to make the point that when you buy insurance, it's not the cost of insurance premiums, but the quality of claim service that's important. If you get a policy with a cheap premium but poor claim service, you're not going to benefit.
And that's absolutely right, and that's a great point to make. I mean, I've dealt with, you know, literally hundreds of companies over my career. Some of them are good, some of them are terrible, and most fall somewhere in between. I think a lot of the, you know, I mentioned American Family, you know, I've dealt with West Bend, who's both local companies, Wisconsin companies, and both very good companies. And there are plenty of others that are good companies. But there are also a lot of them, including a lot of the online companies who, you know, they have no claims people here. So you're dealing with somebody in case of one of the very large online, you know, one of the very large advertisers. You know, their claims people are in Macon, Georgia, you know, and they have no, you know, do they know something about Wisconsin? Yeah, but not very much. Another classic example is State Farm used to have local adjusters. When I started practice, they had two guys who were two of the very best claims people I ever dealt with. They didn't give anything away, but they were very fair. They were very reasonable. State Farm now has moved all their claims people down to Illinois. I actually talked to one of their adjusters not too long before I retired, and it's clear liability, no question at all, auto case. And she made me an offer. I said, you understand that the medical bills are more than that? Oh, well, then I'll increase it by $5,000. You know, and, you know, then you say, fine, well, you know, we won't have to see you in court. We'll file a lawsuit and you'll get a rational lawyer and the lawyer will tell you that's not going to do it. And, you know, we got it settled ultimately. So it does make a difference. The $64,000 question, it's probably $64 million now, is, you know, what do you do about that? I mean, how do you know? And like I said, I think there are, I mentioned a couple of companies, and I'm not damning others with faint praise. There are a lot of companies out there, you know, who I think are good companies and do a good job. But I think you, again, that's one of the reasons I really hesitate to buy online. If you're buying from an agent, particularly if you go to an independent agent, they have to deal with this stuff too. You know, they're not going to pay out the money, but they get involved, and they're the ones who have to field complaints from their insureds if, you know, they don't get good service. So they at least should have a pretty decent idea of who's going to treat you right if and when you have a claim.
Dan in Madison has a question. Dan, hello.
Hi, Larry. Hi. Happy to take my call. Thank you. I had a question with all the recent hail we've had. My insurance company actually denied a coverage request or a claim. Wondering what other options I might have to pursue either through the insurance commissioner of the state or other means to make a case.
And I know Larry just had a hail damage claim. We were talking about that before we started. So couple thoughts. I mean, one, I was telling Larry, we handled a claim some years ago now. It was an apartment complex, and it actually was like a $2 million claim. And the company's initial position was, well, they didn't have to cover it because it wasn't functional. It would still keep out the rain and snow. And they wanted to just replace parts of it with kind of a patchwork. And I said, well, if they're gray shingles now, you're telling me you can just put red shingles on as a patchwork because it doesn't matter what it looks like. And they finally paid the $2 million after some wrangling. But I think, yeah, have they given you a specific reason why they're denying it? Are they denying it in its entirety or just saying they'll only pay so much?
They're denying it in its entirety. I did have a contractor look at it. They're saying the damage is not hail related, but my contractor insists that it is, and mine's in worse shape than several others are getting roofs nearby in our neighborhood. So,
yeah, I think that's one where, first of all, I would file a complaint with the insurance commissioner's office, and I'm sure they're getting plenty of them after all the hailstorms, because that's one. You know, if you're hurt in a car accident, you can, and it's clearly the other person's fault, you can debate, you know, what the value is, but you're not going to debate whether you deserve to be paid money at some level. This thing's different because they're saying we don't have to pay anything. And, you know, you've got a contractor who's looked at it and says it is related. I'd do this. I mean, I'd tell the company you would consider mediating, where you bring in a third party and, you know, try to mediate the claim, because that's the cheapest way to get something like this resolved. Now, the company may or may not do that. If they're not willing to do that, to me, that, you know, that's a little suspect in and of itself, because that's a very fair proposition to say we're willing to do that. And mediation isn't binding unless you both agree. So it's a big difference. Arbitration, if you agree to arbitration, that's binding. Then the arbitrators make a decision and you're both bound by it. Mediation, you're going into a room with a third party, you're both providing him with information in advance, and then ultimately he's going to make a recommendation. He's going to go back and forth and try to see if he can't get the claim resolved. So, you know, I think it would be worth making that suggestion, and then I would tell the company right out that if they're not willing to do that, then you're going to hire an attorney, and because I think that's what you need to do. I mean, you know, replacing roofs is really, I was shocked. My son had to do work on his. He has a one-car garage separate from the house that, I mean, I don't know what the square footage is, but it's tiny. It looks like a tool shed to me. And they wanted like $15,000 to replace the roof on that thing. So, you know, I suspect what you're talking about is real money, and I think it's certainly worth consulting an attorney. And, you know, you should be able to find somebody that'd be willing to handle that.
And good luck, Dan. Thanks a lot for calling. Mike Riley, our guest today, Madison attorney. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here as we talk liability insurance with our guest, Mike Riley. Thanks for joining in today. Mike, you mentioned my roof. My roof was damaged in a big hailstorm. And the insurance company, I got an estimate on the cost, and the insurance company said they'd cover 45% of it. And I actually thought it wasn't a bad deal because the roof itself had been on for 20 years.
Yeah, they're probably talking about depreciation over time and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so it's probably going to have to replace it anyway in a few years. So I thought it was reasonable enough. Yeah. I was happy with that.
I was surprised. One of my good friends had a bunch of hail damage, and he was describing to me the discussions they'd had, and it really was they were putting money in and taking it out, and it was really pretty complex. So, you know, it's a good reason to look at your policy, or, again, to talk to an agent, whether it's a captive or an independent agent, when you buy the policy. You know, in this day and age with the weather we're having, boy, it's a much bigger risk than it used to be. That's for sure that you'd have that kind of damage. I did have one further thought on that last call, Larry. I'll make it quick. One thing that's true, even with good companies, is all adjusters are not created equal. Some of them are real decent and really make an effort to do the right thing. Some of them, frankly, aren't, and, you know, just are hard noses, and they like to be that way, and they think that looks good for them, I guess, when they get their next review. But one of the things I'd always try, if they're just denying, I'd say, can I talk to a manager? And take it up a level, see if they'll, you know, let you talk to one of the managers in the claims department. And sometimes that gets you a different result. Not always, certainly, but sometimes it does. And it's worth at least trying that before you go to the next steps.
Betty in Norwalk will give you a chance. Hi, Betty.
Yes. Hello. Hello. Good to speak with you, Larry and Mike.
Thank you.
My husband's uncle and aunt lived in the Milwaukee area all their adult lives, but she was originally from Norway. And when they retired 25 years ago, she went back to Norway because of her assets there. Well, now they have both passed away. Actually, he'd be 100 years old this week. Yes, but we have a problem here. Norway did all of their work in all the inheritance involved for everybody, but the person here administrating the will for his uncle, cousin of my husband, has not been forthright, and he's done nothing in 3 years. So we're dealing with, and the money, it's $1 million, and it's sitting with a big, well-known company who our hands are tied because we are not the administrators. And so we had a lawyer who said this should have gone to probate in Waukesha County in the first year, so everything's in arrears. But because it's international law, we really are having trouble even getting somebody to help us, you know, move forward. So I'm wondering what suggestions you might have.
It's not international law to begin with, in my view. I mean, they're your assets, you know, and maybe they're in Norway, but the problem is putting it in probate here. That's here. That's not Norway. And it doesn't sound like there's any issues. I mean, it sounds like it's pretty clear who the money belongs to. And frankly, this lawyer's just derelicting his responsibilities, as far as I can tell, based on what you're saying. It's interesting because it echoes a case I thought about talking about today that was in our area where I was actually looking at a car, and the young guy who was helping me said, "Say, you know, you're a lawyer." And I said, "Can you ask you a question?" I said, "Sure." And they had the same kind of thing. They had something that had been in probate for 5 years, which is outrageous. I mean, if you have some kind of major debate going on, I guess it's possible. But even then, it would seem ridiculously long. And 3 years is inexcusable. I mean, I would, first of all, go back to the lawyer and said, you know, look, our next step is to file a complaint with the Office of Lawyer Responsibility, OLR. I can't remember. They change the name, it seems to me, every few years. But basically, there's a lawyer disciplinary group under the state bar. They certainly, the Supreme Court runs that. That's their responsibility to run that group. But you can file a complaint with that organization, and I'd make it clear to the lawyer that, barring, you know, a very persuasive explanation, that's what you're going to do. And I think that'll get him moving. And if it doesn't, I would file the complaint because I don't, you know, again, I'm not there. I haven't seen the papers. I don't know all the ins and outs. But based on just the basic facts that you're telling me, I can't understand why it should have taken that long. And if there were a good excuse, I would think it would have been offered by now by the lawyer. So that's what I do. I mean, I'd go to the lawyer first, and then if that doesn't get you the appropriate action, I would file a complaint.
And maybe make the lawyer know that?
I'd tell him in advance, you know, that this is the next step we're going to take. I believe it's now OLR, Office of Lawyer Responsibility. But it's under the Supreme Court. You can find it easily enough. And, you know, it's not a threat to me. It's a promise. It's saying, look, you haven't done your job. If you have an explanation, you know, tell us what that is. And if you don't, then get this done and get this done now, or we will be filing a complaint. And I'd give him 30 days at most, and then I'd file the complaint because that'll get some action.
Betty, good luck with that. Appreciate your call. Lee in Green Bay, what's on your mind?
Yes, thank you. A quick question on storm damage. My neighbor's home is no more than like 15, 20 yards from the property line. I have 3 big oak trees on my property that have been there for years. My question is, if there's a storm and it takes down part of the tree, one of the trees or whatever, and goes on his roof, am I liable for that?
I don't believe so. And I'll tell you that I don't have 100% confidence in that. But unless you've, you know, if the trees were rotten and the limbs were, you know, hanging by a thread and you don't do anything, then yes, I think you could be held responsible for not properly maintaining them. But, you know, assuming these are trees that to all appearances are healthy, the fact that you have a storm and one of those branches drops on him, I do not believe that makes you liable. And you would have your homeowner's liability coverage would cover that in any event. Now, I understand, yeah, I don't know what your coverage is and whether it would be adequate and all that kind of thing. But first of all, I doubt it. And secondly, your insurance should cover it.
Lee, thank you for calling. Linda emailed, and this goes back to the LLC comment that you'd made earlier. Wondering how much does it cost to set up an LLC and when should you have one?
Well, you should certainly have one if you've got assets that are substantial that would otherwise not be protected. Now, you have to have a basis to set up an LLC. And again, that's just not my bailiwick. You know, I don't, you know, I have never done that, and it's never been part of my practice. But I can tell you a horror story that will make you at least look into it and see how much it would cost and whether it's worthwhile under your circumstances. We had a client who was not my client, but client of the firm's, and they failed to include a bunch of property in an LLC. And they had a trucking company, and one of their drivers had a horrendous accident. And because of the lack of corporate protection for things, I mean, they had at risk multi-million dollars in property that shouldn't have been at risk that was because they hadn't failed to take the appropriate steps to protect that.
That's
I mean, it's, you know, it was properties they'd accumulated over a lifetime of very good business practices and wise investment, and the failure to do that, at least it was still being litigated at, you know, when I left, but, you know, it certainly put at risk a huge amount of assets that should never have been at risk.
I was thinking back, I own some property with some other folks up in northern Wisconsin, a vacation home on some property, and we formed an LLC because we did not want to have, you know, somebody comes and visits and they fall and seriously injured.
Yeah, it's the same kind of thing, Larry. Is it a major risk? No, but why run a risk if you don't have to? You know, and not with something like that.
I mean, it's been years since we did that, and there's a little upkeep that goes on each year, I believe, that to maintain the LLC in one way or another. But we all felt rather than each one of us individually getting somebody going after us as individuals, we did not want to have that happen at all.
No, it's wise, and that's why you should always inquire. I mean, you can't just set up an LLC for every purpose under it, but there are a lot of cases where you can to protect yourself, and it makes absolute sense.
Well, Mike, it has been a pleasure for 30 years talking with you.
It's been a delight. I'm sure everybody who hasn't met you can tell from your voice on the radio what kind of person you are. But I'll tell you, for those of us who have had the privilege of meeting you and being on your show, it is a delight.
Mike, thank you so much. Michael Riley, retired Madison attorney. He and I have been doing this for 30 years, and it's he always brings a lot of great information. And you get a lot of pretty good advice for nothing. Just for listening in.
Thanks, Larry.
Thanks, Mike. And thank you for listening in today. Thanks to our team for creating our shows every day. Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. We'll see you tomorrow. We'll talk. We got Garden Talk tomorrow. And in the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.